Descartes in 90 Minutes by Paul Strathern continued.
Disc 2.
Suddenly, Francine took ill and died. Descartes was devastated. It was the most bitter blow he was to suffer in his lifetime, and according to his biographer Bayet, he wept for his child with a tenderness which showed that the thought of eternity is capable of being extinguished by the grief of the moment. This tragedy occurred while Descartes was finishing his Meditations, generally considered his masterpiece. Although not as immediately appealing as the Discourse on Method, it is graced with the same felicity of style, and its French is a model expression of abstract thought. Descartes gallantly claimed that he had written it with the aim of making abstract ideas exciting to women. This time he took the precaution of sending the manuscript to Father Mersenne in Paris, and asking him to circulate it so that he might discover the opinions of the learned. Descartes wished to have the approval of the scholars and the Jesuits for his new philosophical treatise, which contained an elaboration of the ideas put forward in the Discourse on Method. This time he proposes an even more comprehensive program of doubt. He imagines that the entire universe, even the truths of geometry and the winter dressing gown he is wearing as he sits in front of the fire, may be the work of a malignant, unseen being intent on deceiving him. Psychologists have confidently identified the anti-hero of this fantasy as Judge Joachim Descartes. Once again, the doubtful workings of Descartes' mind arrive at the same indisputable cog, and upon this self-evident principle of ultimate certainty, he once again rebuilds the universe, even going as far as to prove the existence of God with arguments first used by St. Anselm and Thomas Aquinas more than 4 centuries earlier, presumably in order to make the Church feel more comfortable. Although this process of Cartesian doubt was not strictly original, it was considered as such at the time. St. Augustine's remarkably similar doubts and conclusion, put forward 12 centuries earlier, were not central to his thought and had been completely ignored. But more recently, and more interestingly, the Portuguese philosopher Francisco Sanchez had proposed almost the exact same program of comprehensive doubt in his astonishing treatise Quod Nihil Sicitur, Why Nothing Can Be Known. This had been published 60 years before Descartes' Meditations in 1581. Fortunately for Sanchez, his treatise attracted little attention, otherwise he might have ended as a great philosophic martyr at the age of 31. Descartes had no ambitions for martyrdom, and though he possessed many of the qualifications for obscurity, under other circumstances his sloth alone would surely have qualified him, he appears to have had no ambitions in this direction either. He wanted to be heard, but he also wanted to be accepted. He was utterly convinced that he was right, but he wanted the Church to be convinced too. So under his instructions, Father Mersenne sent the manuscript of the Meditations to such luminaries of the European intellectual scene as Gassendi, Hobbes, and Arnauld, and they replied, putting forward their objections to Descartes' theories. These objections irritated Descartes, but he was persuaded to add his replies, and the Meditations were finally published in 1641, complete with objections and Descartes' rebuttals. Inevitably, the publication of Descartes' Meditations provoked an even worse furor. The Jesuits correctly realized that Cartesian doubt and cogito ergo sum spelled the end of scholastic philosophy and Aquinas. Worse still for Descartes, this time the controversy spilled over into Holland. The president of the University of Utrecht accused Descartes of atheism. Ingeniously, he likened Descartes to Vanini, who had been charged with purposely putting forward weak and ineffectual proofs of the existence of God. Vanini had been burned at the stake in 1619 in Toulouse. Even more damaging attacks came from other important Dutch figures, accusing him of heresy. In those days, atheism was one thing, but heresy was a matter of mortal consequences. Fortunately, the French ambassador intervened on Descartes' behalf, and eventually the controversy waned, though for some time afterward Descartes' name and works were not allowed to be mentioned within the precincts of the University of Utrecht. Ultimately, this ban was dropped after the mathematics department complained that they were unable to do geometry without making use of Cartesian coordinates. Descartes was now renowned throughout Europe, his fame stretching so far beyond the intellectual world that he was read even by royalty. When the young Queen Christina of Sweden encountered one of his books, she was so impressed that she invited him to court. He must come to Stockholm and teach her philosophy. By now the long, hard years of late rising and gentlemanly meditation were beginning to take their toll on Descartes. Although only 53, he hadn't moved his home for 4 years. He was now living on a small estate at Egmondbinnen, 20 miles north of Amsterdam, near the sea. He did his meditations sitting in his octagonal study, looking out over a beautiful old garden. Occasionally he would travel to Paris, where he discussed his ideas with old sparring partners like Gassendi, Pascal, Hobbes, and Arnauld. The prospect of a long trip north to Sweden did not appeal, but Queen Christina was a headstrong and determined woman. Only 23 years old, she had already made her mark on her kingdom. Just 5 feet tall, she had broad shoulders and trained like a soldier. It was said that she could gallop for more than 10 hours without tiring, though one wonders about the horse. When she ascended to the throne, she vowed to turn her capital, the watery Venice of the North, into the intellectual Paris of the North. Despite her determined efforts, it remained undeniably the Stockholm of the North. Descartes was her big chance, and she was determined not to let him slip from her grasp. To reinforce her invitation, she sent an admiral and a warship to collect him, but Descartes cavilled, albeit in most gallant fashion, handing to the waiting admiral a flattering missive describing how "Her Majesty was created in the image of God to a greater degree than the rest of mankind," but prayed to be excused from "basking in the sunbeams of her glorious presence." Christina stamped her foot. The court had a bad day, and another ship was dispatched to fetch the immobile philosopher. Descartes, who had defeated the finest minds of Europe in intellectual argument, was forced to concede defeat. In October 1649 he sailed for Stockholm. There he was welcomed by the Queen and had 2 personal audiences with her. Christina appeared to have absorbed little philosophy from the study of his works, and then she found she had other matters to attend to. Descartes was left to amuse himself for 6 weeks, while the bitter Swedish winter set in. It was to be the worst for 60 years, the city ice-bound for 6 months, gloom at noon, and beyond the suburbs the wolves howling in the frigid blast beneath the aurora borealis. Midway through January, when Christina decided it was time she started her philosophy lessons, Descartes was duly summoned. The Queen, he was informed, would have 3 philosophy lessons a week, each starting at 5 a.m. Even in the army Descartes had never risen before 11 a.m. The shock of rising at 4 a.m. in deepest Scandinavian winter, attending to his toilet with French fastidiousness during the hour of the wolf, followed by a fast, bumpy sleigh ride over the iron-iced streets through the piercing Arctic blast. There's no point in even trying to imagine how he felt. Within 2 weeks he caught a chill, which soon turned into pneumonia. A week later he became delirious, and on February the 11th, 1650, he died. One of the great minds of Europe had been sacrificed to the whim of royalty. As a Catholic, in Protestant Sweden, this deeply religious man could not be buried in sacred ground, but had to be interred in the cemetery for unbaptized children. 13 years later, the Catholic Church honored Descartes' memory by placing all his works on its Index of Banned Books, a tradition that continues to this day, when Plato's Symposium was recently put on the index in Ireland. Later in the 17th century, Descartes' body was transferred to Paris, where it was reinterred. During the Revolution, a proposal was put forward that he should be exhumed again and placed in the Pantheon, alongside other great French thinkers. This was put to the National Assembly. In an unusual move, the members divided along scientific lines. Those who favoured the mechanistic Cartesian view of the universe were opposed by members who supported the new Newtonian theory of gravity. Descartes had proposed the theory of vortices to explain how the universe worked. His theory maintained that the movement of one particle affected the movement of all other particles throughout the universe. This took place through a series of interlocking vortices, which encompassed everything from the solar system and the stars down to the smallest particles. This would, of course, have resulted in a system of fiendish complexity, such as only a mathematician could conceive. Yet it points to a matter of some interest in the evolution of human thought. Descartes' theory bears a passing resemblance both to the double helix of DNA and the superstring theory of ultimate particles. Also, in his long search for a force that could interact between mind and body, Descartes was looking for something similar to radio waves or electricity. According to the modern thinker Jean de Mondeville, this points to the possibility that human understanding evolves along certain conceptual lines almost regardless of its object. In the vote in the French National Assembly, the Newtonians managed to muster sufficient support to defeat the Cartesians. Gravity had won the day, and Descartes would have to be buried elsewhere. Formerly, the truth had been the province of theology. Now it had entered the realm of democracy. Descartes didn't fit into either. Appropriately, he is now buried in the church of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, in the heart of the Latin Quarter in Paris, where his tradition of doubtful thinking and noon rising is staunchly maintained to this day. Afterword. Descartes brought philosophy back to life. His revolutionary new way of thinking about the world and our status in it gradually transformed European thought. Things would never be the same again. He instigated a widespread rejection of the moribund Aristotelianism that had gained such a stranglehold on the European mind. From this time on, Aristotelianism was no longer taken seriously by the leading philosophers of the day, though its deathly influence lingered on in universities and seminaries for years to come. This residue was not entirely to philosophy's detriment. The next generation of philosophers, including Leibniz, Locke, Berkeley, and Hume, all had to endure an Aristotelian education. This stupefying experience inspired each of them. Philosophy just couldn't go on like this, and instead they decided to think for themselves. Each, in turn, began looking for an alternative method of thought, and each, in turn, discovered Descartes. Being genuine philosophers, they soon found objections to this new philosophy. No great philosopher worthy of the calling ever accepts the thought of his predecessors without question. For him there can be only one incontrovertible way of thinking, his own. As a result, these new philosophers each set about constructing their own incontrovertible explanation of the world and its problems. Yet all these thinkers, whether they reject or develop Descartes' ideas, stand in his debt. With Descartes, the primacy of the individual and the analysis of human consciousness became fundamental to philosophy. Emphasis was also placed on reason rather than dogma. From now on, problems could be approached from a reasonable point of view. Solutions that didn't square with teachings founded on the experiences of a resourceful Bronze Age tribe or the ideas of a Balkan wise man who had died almost 2,000 years earlier were not necessarily dismissed out of hand. As with all such revolutionary figures, Descartes attracted his inevitable band of followers. They developed his ideas into the philosophy that became known as Cartesianism, and it was now that the shortcomings of Descartes' philosophy became exposed. Descartes insisted on the rational approach. The problems of philosophy could be solved by analyzing them with the use of reason alone. His famous all-embracing process of doubt left this as the only certain evidence. Doubting the evidence of the senses led him to deny experience as a source of certain knowledge. Here, for once, Aristotle remained right. Science could only be based on experience. In Descartes' view, the universe was entirely mechanistic. The physical and biological aspects of the world all worked like a machine, and its innermost mechanics could thus, in theory at least, all be calculated. Belief in this approach remains to this day. Not only is the assessment of subnuclear particles largely a matter of calculation, but we believe that the answers must be susceptible to calculation. Descartes' negation of experience as a certain source of knowledge was soon to prove an embarrassment. Europe was now entering a great age of scientific discovery, which was to reach a peak in Newton's conception of universal gravity. The advances made during this period, from Harvey's discovery of the circulation of the blood to Halley's discovery of his comet, depended almost exclusively upon observation. At the same time, philosophy too rejected Descartes. The British thinkers Locke, Berkeley, and Hume turned to empiricism, the belief in the primacy of experience as the source of our knowledge. Yet Cartesianism was not entirely exploded. The Cartesians included some colourful figures, and a number became champions of the scientific revolution. The Parisian Regis conducted sensational demonstrations of the new Cartesian physics at his public lectures, which became so popular that they were closed down by Louis XIV as a danger to public order. Descartes' best-known follower was the French priest Malebranche, who became so convinced of Descartes' mechanistic ideas that he believed in kicking dogs to demonstrate that they were nothing but machines with utterly predictable responses. Boot, bark. Malebranche acknowledged that Descartes had failed to explain the interaction of mind and body, but he put forward the theory of occasionalism to overcome this gap. According to Malebranche, the mind and the body occupy two entirely separate worlds, which never interact and are incapable of affecting each other. But what happens when the mind wills the foot to move, and it then kicks the dog? On every occasion when the mind wills something in its separate mental world, Malebranche explained, God arranges for the material world to undergo a parallel adjustment. There is no such thing as cause and effect, just two separate parallel worlds. According to occasionalism, these two worlds act in concert on all occasions through the agency of God. The ingenuity of the new science still had a long way to go before it could match the ingenuity of the old theology. Descartes' last notable follower was the 18th-century philosopher Lemaître. He took the logical step of dismissing the mental world and insisting upon a purely mechanistic materialism, with no place for parallel universes or even for God. Lemaître ended up as court philosopher to Frederick the Great, where he found it prudent to keep quiet about his atheism. But it was an over-enthusiastic demonstration of his thoroughgoing materialism that eventually led to his demise. He died after consuming a surfeit of pheasant pâté, attempting to prove the mechanics of the digestive system to fellow court intellectuals. Descartes' insistence on the primacy of the individual and the analysis of human consciousness were to prove his most lasting legacies. Both rationalism and the opposing empiricism agreed upon the need for such an emphasis, and in one form or another this attitude continued to dominate philosophy until comparatively recently. Only with the arrival of logical analysis was the primacy of the individual and the analysis of human consciousness superseded by the primacy of the dictionary and the analysis of its contents. Once more, philosophy stands in need of a Descartes to bring it back to life. From Descartes' Writings. It is some time since I first realized how many false opinions I accepted as true from my childhood, and how doubtful was the entire structure of thought which I had built upon them. I therefore understood that I must, if I wanted to establish anything at all in science that was firm and liable to last, once and for all rid myself of all the opinions I had adopted, and start from an entirely new foundation. Meditations 1. A multitude of laws often hampers justice, so that a state is best governed when it has only a few laws which are strictly administered. Similarly, instead of the large number of laws which make up logic, I was of the opinion that the four following laws were perfectly sufficient for me, provided I took the firm and unwavering resolution to stick to them clearly at all times. The first was never to accept anything as true if I did not clearly know it to be so. That is, carefully to avoid precipitate conclusions and preconceptions, and to include nothing more in my judgment than was presented clearly and distinctly to my mind, so that I had no reason to doubt it. The second, to divide each of the difficulties I examined into as many parts as possible, and as might be necessary for a proper solution. The third, to conduct my thoughts in an orderly fashion, by starting with the simplest and most easily known objects, so that I could ascend, little by little, and step by step, to more complex knowledge, and by giving some order even to those objects which appeared to have none. And the last, always to make enumerations so complete, and reviews so comprehensive, that I could be sure of leaving nothing out. Discourse on Method, Part 1. The long chains of simple and easy reasonings which geometers use to reach the most difficult conclusions had given me reason to suppose that all things which can be known by humanity are connected in some way, and that there is nothing so far removed from us as to be beyond our reach, or so hidden that we cannot discover it, as long as we abstain from accepting the false for the true, and always preserve in our thoughts the order necessary for the deduction of one truth from another. Also, I had little difficulty in determining the objects with which it was necessary to commence, for I was already convinced that these must be the simplest and easiest known. Discourse on Method, Part 2. Since I desired to devote myself wholly to the search for truth, I thought it necessary to reject as if utterly false anything in which I could discover the least grounds for doubt, so that I could find out if I was left with anything at all which was absolutely indubitable. Thus, because our senses sometimes deceive us, I decided to suppose that nothing was really as they led us to believe it was. And, because some of us make mistakes in reasoning, committing logical errors in even the simplest matters of geometry, I rejected as erroneous all reasonings that I had previously taken as proofs. And finally, when I considered that the very same things we perceive when we are awake may also occur to us while we are asleep, and not perceiving anything at all, I resolved to pretend that anything that had ever entered my mind was no more than a dream. But immediately I noticed that while I was thinking in this way, and regarding everything as false, it was nonetheless absolutely necessary that I, who was doing this thinking, was still something. And observing that this truth, I think, therefore I am, was so sure and certain that no ground for doubt, be it ever so extravagantly sceptical, was capable of shaking it, I therefore decided that I could accept it without scruple as the first principle of the philosophy I was seeking to create. Discourse on Method, Part 4. There is a vast difference between the mind and the body, in that the body by its very nature is always divisible, while the mind is completely indivisible. For when I consider the mind, or rather when I consider myself simply as a thinking thing, I find I can distinguish no parts within myself, and I clearly discern that I am a thing utterly one and complete. Although my whole mind seems to be united to my whole body, when a foot or an arm or any other part is severed, I am not conscious of anything having been removed from my mind. Nor can the faculties of willing, perceiving, conceptualizing, and so forth in any way be called parts of the mind, as it is always the same mind which is doing the willing, perceiving, conceptualizing, and so forth. Meanwhile, utterly the opposite holds for all corporeal or extended things, for I cannot imagine any one of them which I cannot in my thoughts easily split into parts, and thus I understand that it is divisible. Meditations 6. Good sense is most evenly distributed among all humanity, for all consider themselves to be so well endowed with it that even those who complain of their lot in all other ways seldom express the desire for more good sense. And here it is unlikely that everyone is mistaken. It shows, rather, that the power of correct judgment, and the ability to distinguish truth from error, what we properly call good sense or reason, is by nature equally given to all humanity. As a result, the diversity of our opinions does not arise from any of us being endowed with a greater quantity of reason, but solely because we direct our thoughts in different directions, and do not pay attention to the same things. For it is not enough just to have a fine mind. The main thing is to learn how to apply it properly. The finest minds are capable of both the greatest vices as well as the greatest virtues, and those who travel slowly often make better progress, as long as they follow the right path, than those who rush ahead and stray from it. Discourse on Method, Part 1. The nature of clear and distinct perception. There are some people who throughout their entire lives perceive nothing in the correct fashion so as to be capable of judging it properly. The knowledge upon which a certain and incontrovertible judgment can be based must not only be clear, but also distinct. Whatever is present and apparent to an attentive mind I call clear, in the same fashion as we assert that we see objects clearly when they are present to our gazing eye, and make a strong impression upon it. But a thing that is distinct is so precise and different from all other objects that it contains within itself nothing else but what is clear. Principles of Philosophy, Principle 45. Chronology of Descartes' life. 1596. René Descartes, born March the 31st. 1606. Enters Jesuit College at La Flèche. 1614 to 1616. Studies for law degree at Poitiers. 1618. Joins army of the Prince of Orange in Holland. Meets physicist Beeckmann. 1619 to 1628. Travels through Europe. Studying from the Book of the World. 1619. Has dreams which convince him to dedicate his life to thought. 1620. Conceives of his universal method in a stove in Bavaria. 1622 to 1624. Moves to Paris. Meets Father Mersenne, who is in correspondence with many of the great minds of Europe. 1628. Moves to the Netherlands. 1633. Writes Le Monde, the world, but suppresses publication after the Church condemns Galileo. 1635. Birth of Descartes' daughter, Francine. 1637. Publishes Discourse on Method. 1640. Death of his daughter causes Descartes profound grief. 1641. Publishes Meditations on the First Philosophy, which contains his famous assertion, Cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. 1648. Death of his friend Father Mersenne in Paris. 1649. Travels to court of Queen Christina in Sweden. 1650. Dies in Stockholm on February the 11th. Chronology of Descartes' era. 1598. Edict of Nantes grants toleration to Huguenots, French Protestants. 1599. Birth of Velasquez. 1600. Population of Europe reaches 100 million, having doubled in previous 150 years. 1600s. French begin settling Canada. 1605. Francis Bacon publishes Advancement of Learning, which proposes scientific method in place of Aristotelianism. 1607. Founding of Jamestown in America. 1609. Founding of Bank of Amsterdam breaks monopoly of private banking families. 1616. Death of Cervantes. Death of Shakespeare. 1618. Start of the 30 Years' War, which spreads throughout Europe. 1620. Pilgrim Fathers reach Cape Cod. 1621. United Provinces of the Netherlands at war with Spain. 1624. French Parlement passes decree forbidding attacks on Aristotle on pain of death. 1628. Harvey publishes work describing circulation of the blood. 1629. Peace after religious wars in France. 1639. Birth of Racine. 1642. Death of Galileo, birth of Newton. 1646. Birth of Leibniz. 1648. End of 30 Years' War, leaving large parts of Europe, especially Germany, devastated. 1649. Revolution in England deposes Charles I. Chronology of Significant Philosophical Dates. 6th century BC. The beginning of Western philosophy, with Thales of Miletus. End of the 6th century BC. Death of Pythagoras. 399 BC. Socrates sentenced to death in Athens. Circa 387 BC. Plato founds the Academy in Athens, the first university. 335 BC. Aristotle founds the Lyceum in Athens, a rival school to the Academy. 324 AD. Emperor Constantine moves capital of Roman Empire to Byzantium. 400 AD. St. Augustine writes his Confessions, philosophy absorbed into Christian theology. 410 AD. Sack of Rome by Visigoths heralds opening of Dark Ages. 529 AD. closure of academy in Athens by Emperor Justinian marks end of Hellenic thought. Mid-13th century, Thomas Aquinas writes his commentaries on Aristotle, Era of Scholasticism. 1453, fall of Byzantium to Turks, end of Byzantine Empire. 1492, Columbus reaches America, Renaissance in Florence and revival of interest in Greek learning. 1543, Copernicus publishes On the Revolution of the Celestial Orbs, proving mathematically that the Earth revolves around the Sun. 1633, Galileo forced by Church to recant heliocentric theory of the universe. 1641, Descartes publishes his Meditations, the start of modern philosophy. 1677, death of Spinoza allows publication of his Ethics. 1687, Newton publishes Principia, introducing concept of gravity. 1689, Locke publishes Essay Concerning Human Understanding, start of empiricism. 1710, Berkeley publishes Principles of Human Knowledge, advancing empiricism to new extremes. 1716, death of Leibniz. 1739-1740, Hume publishes Treatise of Human Nature, taking empiricism to its logical limits. 1781, Kant, awakened from his dogmatic slumbers by Hume, publishes Critique of Pure Reason. Great era of German metaphysics begins. 1807, Hegel publishes The Phenomenology of Mind, high point of German metaphysics. 1818, Schopenhauer publishes The World as Will and Representation, introducing Indian philosophy into German metaphysics. 1889, Nietzsche, having declared God is dead, succumbs to madness in Turin. 1921, Wittgenstein publishes Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, claiming the final solution to the problems of philosophy. 1920s, Vienna Circle propounds logical positivism. 1927, Heidegger publishes Being and Time, heralding split between analytical and continental philosophy. 1943, Sartre publishes Being and Nothingness, advancing Heidegger's thought and instigating existentialism. 1953, posthumous publication of Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations, high era of linguistic analysis. This concludes the reading of Descartes in 90 Minutes by Paul Strathern. The book was read by Robert Whitfield. For other audiobooks from the Philosophers in 90 Minutes series, or if you would like to obtain a complete printed catalogue of our titles or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD, write to Blackstone Audiobooks, P.O. Box 969, Ashland, Oregon 97520, or call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.